Welcome to Learning English from the Voice of America. I'm Katie Weaver. Today on the show, we have reports from Ashley Thompson and Anna Mateo. We close the show with our American Stories program. We will hear the final part of Love of Life by Jack London. But first, ModernWell is a shared workspace in Minneapolis, Minnesota. Outside the building, the city is covered with snow and the temperature is well below freezing. But ModernWell is warm and inviting. Comfortable chairs and footrests surround the warmth of the fireplace. Women work on laptops at tables around the room. There is not a man to be seen. That is because ModernWell is one of a growing number of women-only and women-centered workspaces around the country. The increase of such spaces has been linked to the Me Too movement against sexual harassment and similar wrongdoing. The spaces represent a growing desire among many women to build a supportive environment at work that is different from the usual business culture. Workplaces like ModernWell provide more than just tables, chairs, and a coffee maker. They also offer programs like yoga and other fitness activities, a speaker series, and writing classes. Renee Powers is a ModernWell member. I think women, especially, are craving safe spaces. There's literally no risk that somebody's going to sexual harass me here, Powers said. She established her business, Feminist Book Club, at ModernWell. The biggest shared workspace business is The Wing, which opened in 2016 in New York. It has quickly expanded across the country. Its site in San Francisco, California, opened in October. It includes a conference room named for Christine Blasey Ford. She is the woman who spoke at the Senate confirmation hearing on Supreme Court nominee Brett Kavanaugh. She told the Senate that he had sexually attacked her in high school. Kavanaugh denied the claim and was later confirmed to the court. Membership to one of the Wing spaces costs $2,350 a year. Company spokeswoman Zara Rahim said the business now has more than 6,000 members. Most of the spaces permit men, but some do not. The Wing faced legal action by a man in Washington, D.C., who said he was discriminated against. Shortly after, company leaders approved a membership policy that barred sexual identity as a factor in considering admissions. Rahim said the policy was already being developed before the legal action. The New York City Commission on Human Rights is also investigating The Wing for possible sex discrimination. The company said it is working with the commission. Another fast-growing space is The Riveter, with 5 sites in Seattle, Washington, and Los Angeles, California. Another is to open in March in Austin, Texas. And this week, The Riveter announced plans to open 5 more sites in cities including Minneapolis and Atlanta, Georgia. Amy Nelson established The Riveter and serves as its chief. She said the majority of members are small businesses with just a few employees, or people who work independently. The price for membership starts at $99 a month. About 25% of the Riveters' 2,000 members are men, Nelson said. But she said the difference is that, out of the gate, we're putting women first. I think that we're seeing a societal shift that isn't going to go away, she said. Women's voices are being heard. The Riveter has brought in famous speakers, such as business leader Sheryl Sandberg. Modern Well founder Julie Burton is a writer and wellness teacher. She leads yoga classes at her space, which also offers events such as classes on writing about one's personal life. Burton said her space developed from a women-only writing group she helped form in 2015. After the 2016 presidential election, she said many women she knew were upset. So she decided to build a business to help women support each other and empower themselves. Whether you are out marching or not marching, I felt we had work to do, and I wanted to be part of the work, she said. Jasna Burza, a life and business coach, has a home office but likes to do her work at Modern Well. There, she finds a community of women. On a recent day at Modern Well, Burza said, I come here, and it's my happy place.
Visitors to a Native American reservation's famous waterfalls deep in the Grand Canyon will now have to visit without professional guides. An estimated 40,000 people visit the Havasupai Indian Reservation every year. They come to see a series of blue-green waterfalls, which flow into swimming holes that stay warm year-round. There are no roads to the falls. The only way to arrive is by horse, helicopter, or by foot. The hike is long and at times dangerous. Beginning in February, visitors will have to find their own way down and carry their own food and belongings. For years, professional guides have paid the tribe money to bring visitors to the falls. The tribe could not say how much money it has received from guides over the years. Abby Fink is a spokeswoman for the Havasupai tribe. She told the Associated Press that tribe members want to lead the visitors themselves. She said, it's returning the enterprise to the control of the tribe. The tribe works on the campground and the trails during the months of December and January. It does not permit day visits. So visitors wanting to see the falls must stay overnight at a campsite on the reservation or in the tribe's only building. Rooms in the tribe's building are sold out for the rest of 2019. Permits for camping were available for sale starting February 1st. About 300 camping permits a day are available. Adam Henry is co-owner of Discovery Treks. The guide company usually brings between 100 and 200 visitors to the waterfalls each year. Now, the company will have to offer trips to different places in the Grand Canyon. He says the new rules do not bring good news for those who wish to visit the falls. Visitors will have to walk 13 kilometers down a winding trail through desert before reaching the first waterfall, where 600 tribe members live year-round. To reach the campground with waterfalls on both ends, visitors must walk another 3 kilometers down the trail. The blue-green water is what people want to see, Henry said. It's certainly a significant bummer for people who aren't going to be able to get out there on their own. I'm Ashley Thompson.
The internet can be a dark, oppressive place. Readers sometimes do not show their true identities and feel free to leave cruel comments. So naturally, a school teacher in the U.S. state of Florida felt worried when her son wanted to share her artwork on the social media site Reddit. Cindy Decker had recently taken an art class and made a painting of a huge white bird called an egret. Her proud son posted a photograph of Decker shyly holding her painting. Below it, he wrote, "My mom painted this and said no one would like it. It's her second painting." Far from not liking it, more than 24,000 people upvoted her painting, meaning they liked it. Then a professional artist in Sweden saw the photo on Reddit. Christopher Zetterstrand creates, among other things, paintings for the video game Minecraft. He decided to pay tribute to the mother schoolteacher by painting Decker holding her painting. He even captured the shy look on her face. Zetterstrand photographed himself holding his painting of Decker holding her painting. He posted the image on Reddit. The caption for his photograph is, "I painted somebody's mom." Then, 2 days later, a journalism student in Canada, Leila Amer, painted a picture of Zetterstrand holding his painting of Decker holding her painting. She posted a photo of her holding her painting on Reddit. Her caption read, "But I painted the guy who painted the other guy's mom." Well, then the internet stepped in and took over as only the internet can. The meme took off. The artist Vince Law was the next to join in. The caption for his photo of his painting is, "I painted the girl who painted the guy who painted the other guy's mom who painted an egret." Then, artist Tracy Sethra painted Law's painting of Amer holding Zetterstrand's painting holding Decker's painting. She wrote, "I painted the guy who painted the girl who painted the guy who painted the mom who painted the bird." Artist Travis Simpson continued the fun, and it happened again and again and again. In the very later paintings, the image of the original inspiration, Decker's egret, is so small you can barely see it. Many artists around the world jumped into the process, many at the same time. It began to get confusing. People started calling the egret a swan. So someone stepped in and created a flowchart to show how the paintings developed. The painting styles were all quite different. They began showing up not just on Reddit, but on other social media platforms such as Facebook. By this time, more than 1 million people had seen the paintings and pictures of paintings online. Cindy Decker told a reporter from The Washington Post that she had been named the honorary mom of Reddit. Christopher Zetterstrand, who first painted Decker, told reporters that he has received thousands of comments on Reddit and hundreds of messages and emails. He says millions of people have now seen his painting on a number of social media websites. In interviews, he said the whole experience has been really funny and strange. Zetterstrand and Decker have been in touch with one another. He sent her his painting of her holding her painting as a gift. Instead of the cruel comments she was expecting, Decker said so many people have been very kind to her. She joined Reddit just so she could thank them. She wrote, "I was in fear I was going to read a lot of hateful comments. You all have proven me so wrong. I'm assuming most of you could be my kids, and you all get a bad rap in this world. You all are compassionate, caring, and a ton of fun. Thanks for uplifting me. You all have inspired me instead." People on the internet also have asked her to post her next painting, but Decker said that she has no plans to do so. She says she does not want to wear out her welcome. She is happy to be famous just once. To use another English expression, it's better to leave at the height of the party. I'm Anna Mateo.
Love of Life by Jack London, Part 4.
In the afternoon, the man came to a track. It was that of another man who did not walk, but who dragged himself on his hands and knees. The man thought it might be Bill, but he thought about it without any interest. He had no curiosity. Feeling and emotion had left him. He was no longer able to feel pain, yet the life that was in him drove him ahead. He was very tired, but it refused to die. It was because it refused to die that he still ate muskeg berries and small fish, drank his hot water, and kept a careful eye on the sick wolf. He followed the track of the other man who dragged himself along. Soon he came to the end of it. There were a few freshly cleaned bones where the grass was marked by the footprints of many wolves. He saw a moose skin bag, exactly like his own. It had been torn by sharp teeth. He picked it up, although its weight was almost too much for his weak fingers. Bill had carried it to the end. Now he would have the last laugh. He would live and carry it to the ship in the shining sea. He laughed aloud, making an inhuman sound, and the sick wolf howled with him. The man ceased suddenly. How could he laugh at Bill, if that were Bill? If those bones, so pinky white and clean, were Bill? He turned away. Bill had deserted him. But he would not take the gold, nor would he eat Bill's bones. Bill would have done so, however, had their situations been exchanged. He came to a pool of water. Bending over it in search of fish, he threw his head back as if he had been struck. He had caught sight of his face in the water. So awful was it that his feelings were stirred long enough to be shocked. There were three fish in the pool, which was too large to empty. After several attempts to catch them in his tin container, he stopped. He was afraid, because of his great weakness, that he might fall and sink into the water. It was for this reason, too, that he did not trust himself to ride down the river atop one of the many logs to be found along its banks. That day he lessened the distance between him and the ship by 3 miles. The next day he traveled only 2 miles. Because he was now dragging himself on his hands and knees, as Bill had done. At the end of the fifth day, the ship was still 7 miles away. He was unable to travel as much as a mile a day. However, the summer weather continued, and he continued to move toward the ship. And always the sick wolf coughed at his heels. His knees had become red meat like his feet. Although he bound them with the shirt from his back, it was a red track he left behind him on the grass and stones. Once, glancing back, he saw the wolf licking his bloody track hungrily. He saw clearly what his own end might be, unless he could kill the wolf. Then began as awful an event as has ever been told. Two sick creatures, dragging their dying bodies across a wasteland and hunting each other's lives. Had it been a well wolf, it would not have mattered so much to the man. But the thought of feeding the mouth of that nearly dead thing was hateful. His mind had begun to wander again, and he was troubled by hallucinations. His reasonable moments grew shorter. He was awakened once from a faint sleep by a cough close to his ear. The wolf leaped back, losing its footing and falling in its weakness. It was a funny sight, but he could not laugh. Nor was he afraid. He was too far gone for that. But his mind was, for the moment, clear, and he lay and considered. The ship was no more than 4 miles away. He could see it quite well when he rubbed his eyes. He could also see the white sail of a small boat cutting the water of the shining sea. But he could never drag himself those 4 miles. He knew that, and was very calm about the fact. He knew that he could not travel another half a mile, and yet he wanted to live. It was unreasonable that he should die after all he had been through. Fate asked too much of him. And dying, he could not accept death. It was madness, perhaps. But in the very grasp of death, he refused to die. He closed his eyes and tried to keep himself calm. He struggled against the awful desire for sleep that threatened him. It was much like a sea, this deadly sleepiness. It rose and rose, mastering his entire self bit by bit. Sometimes he was almost lost, swimming through its waters with a weakening effort. Then, by some strange power of the soul, his will would strike out more strongly against it. Without movement, he lay on his back. He could hear slowly drawing nearer and nearer. The sound of the sick wolf's breathing. It came closer, always closer, and he did not move. It was beside his ear. The dry tongue moved across his face. His hands struck out. Actually, he had willed them to strike out. The fingers were curved, but they closed on empty air. Quickness requires strength, and the man had not his strength. The quiet waiting of the wolf was awful. The man's waiting was no less awful. For half a day he lay without motion, fighting off sleep. He waited for the thing that was to feed upon him, and upon which he wished to feed. Sometimes the sea of sleep rose over him, and he dreamed long dreams. But always through it all, waking and dreaming, he waited for the noisy breath and the feel of the tongue. This time he did not hear the breath. He slipped slowly from some dream to feel the tongue along his hand. He waited. The teeth pressed softly, then more firmly. The wolf was using its last strength in an effort to sink its teeth into the food for which it had waited so long. But the man, too, had waited long. The hand closed on the wolf's mouth. Slowly, while the wolf struggled weakly, the other hand moved across the wolf's body. 5 minutes later, the whole weight of the man's body was on top of the wolf. The hands had not sufficient strength to grasp the wolf about the throat until it died, but the face of the man was pressed close to the throat of the wolf, and the mouth of the man was full of hair. At the end of half an hour, the man felt some warm drops of blood in his throat. It was not pleasant. It was like hot melted metal being forced into his stomach, and it was forced by his will alone. Later, the man rolled on his back and slept. There were some scientists traveling on the fishing ship Bedford. From where they stood on the ship, they could see a strange object on the shore. It was moving down the beach toward the water. They were unable to decide what it was. Being men of science, they climbed into a smaller boat and went ashore to examine it. And they saw something that was alive, but which could hardly be called a man. It was blind and did not know what it was doing. Its movements produced little effect, but still, it continued to drag itself across the ground at the rate of about 20 feet an hour. 3 weeks later, the man lay in a bed on the fishing boat. With tears streaming down his face, he told who he was and what he had experienced. He also talked without meaning about his mother and a home in California among the flowers. The days were not many after that, when he sat at table with the scientists and the ship's officers. He delighted in the sight of so much food and watched it carefully as it went into the mouths of others. With the disappearance of each mouthful, an expression of sorrow came into his eyes. He was not mad, however. He hated those men at mealtimes. He was afraid that there would not be enough food. He inquired of the cook, the cabin boy, the captain, concerning the food supply. They reassured him numerous times, but he would not believe them, and went into the kitchen to see with his own eyes. It was noticed that the man was getting fat. He grew bigger with each day. The scientists shook their heads and gave their opinions on the problem. They limited the amount of food given to the man at his meals, but still his weight increased. The seamen smiled. They knew. And when the scientists decided to observe the man, they learned the reason. They saw him walk about the ship after breakfast. Like a man begging with an outstretched hand, he approached a seaman. The seaman smiled and gave him a piece of bread. He grasped it and looked at it as a greedy man looks at gold. Then he put it inside his shirt. He received similar gifts from other smiling seamen. The scientists were careful. They allowed him to continue. But they secretly examined his bed. It was lined with bread. Every inch of space was filled with bread. Yet he was not mad. He was preparing for another possible famine, that was all. He would recover from it, the scientists said. And he did. Even before the Bedford sailed into San Francisco Bay.
And that's our show for today. From VOA Learning English, I'm Katie Weaver. Thanks for listening.